continue holding out the second purse, or another 1,000 to show you that I am a man who is better than his word. After hearing of such generosity, the world will talk of nothing else. I shall return home with the same pomp as I set out, and my wife will send an officer to compliment me on my visit to her father, and I shall confer on the officer the honor of a rich dress and a handsome gift. Should she send one to me, I shall refuse it and dismiss the bearer. I shall never allow my wife to leave her rooms on any pretext whatever without my permission, and my visits to her will be marked by all the ceremony calculated to inspire respect. No establishment will be better ordered than mine, and I shall take care always to be dressed in a manner suitable to my position. In the evening, when we retire to our apartments, I shall sit in the place of honor, where I shall assume a grand demeanor and speak little, gazing straight before me, and when my wife, lovely as the full moon, stands humbly in front of my chair, I shall pretend not to see her. Then her women will say to me, "Respected lord and master, your wife and slave is before you, waiting to be noticed. She is mortified that you never deigned to look her way. She is tired of standing so long. Beg her, we pray you, to be seated." Of course I shall give no signs of even hearing this speech, which will vex them mightily. They will throw themselves at my feet with lamentations, and at length I will raise my head and throw a careless glance at her, then I shall go back to my former attitude. The women will think that I am displeased at my wife's dress, and will lead her away to put on a finer one, and I, on my side, shall replace the one I am wearing with another yet more splendid. They will then return to the charge, but this time it will take much longer before they persuade me even to look at my wife. It is as well to begin on my wedding day, as I mean to go on for the rest of our lives. The next day she will complain to her mother of the way she has been treated, which will fill my heart with joy. Her mother will come to seek me, and, kissing my hands with respect, will say, "My lord," for she could not dare to risk my anger by using the familiar title of son-in-law. "My lord, do not, I implore you, refuse to look upon my daughter or to approach her. She only lives to please you and loves you with all her soul." But I shall pay no more heed to my mother-in-law's words than I did to those of the women. Again she will beseech me to listen to her entreaties, throwing herself this time at my feet, but all to no purpose. Then, putting a glass of wine into my wife's hand, she will say to her, "There, present that to him yourself. He cannot have the cruelty to reject anything offered by so beautiful a hand." And my wife will take it and offer it to me tremblingly, with tears in her eyes, but I shall look in the other direction. This will cause her to weep still more, and she will hold out the glass, crying, "Adorable husband, never shall I cease my prayers till you have done me the favor to drink." Sick of her importunities, these words will goad me to fury. I shall dart an angry look at her and give her a sharp blow on the cheek, at the same time giving her a kick so violent that she will stagger across the room and fall onto the sofa.
"My brother," pursued the barber, "was so much absorbed in his dreams that he actually did give a kick with his foot, which unluckily hit the basket of glass. It fell into the street and was instantly broken into 1,000 pieces. His neighbor, the tailor, who had been listening to his visions, broke into a loud fit of laughter as he saw this sight.
'Wretched man!'
he cried.
'You ought to die of shame at behaving so to a young wife who has done nothing to you. You must be a brute for her tears and prayers not to touch your heart. If I were the Grand Vizier, I would order you 100 blows from a bullock whip, and would have you led around the town accompanied by a herald who should proclaim your crimes.'
The accident, so fatal to all his profits, had restored my brother to his senses, and seeing that the mischief had been caused by his own insufferable pride, he rent his clothes and tore his hair, and lamented himself so loudly that the passers-by stopped to listen. It was a Friday, so these were more numerous than usual. Some pitied Alnishar, others only laughed at him. But the vanity which had gone to his head had disappeared with his basket of glass, and he was loudly bewailing his folly when a lady, evidently a person of consideration, rode by on a mule.
She stopped and inquired what was the matter, and why the man wept. They told her that he was a poor man who had laid out all his money on this basket of glass, which was now broken. On hearing the cause of these loud wails, the lady turned to her attendant and said to him, "Give him whatever you have got with you." The man obeyed and placed in my brother's hands a purse containing 500 pieces of gold. Alnishar almost died of joy on receiving it. He blessed the lady 1,000 times, and, shutting up his shop where he had no longer anything to do, he returned home. He was still absorbed in contemplating his good fortune when a knock came to his door, and on opening it he found an old woman standing outside. "My son," she said, "I have a favor to ask of you. It is the hour of prayer, and I have not yet washed myself. Let me, I beg you, enter your house and give me water." My brother, although the old woman was a stranger to him, did not hesitate to do as she wished. He gave her a vessel of water and then went back to his place and his thoughts, and with his mind busy over his last adventure, he put his gold into a long and narrow purse, which he could easily carry in his belt. During this time the old woman was busy over her prayers, and when she had finished she came and prostrated herself twice before my brother, and then rising, called down endless blessings on his head. Observing her shabby clothes, my brother thought that her gratitude was in reality a hint that he should give her some money to buy some new ones. So he held out 2 pieces of gold. The old woman started back in surprise, as if she had received an insult.
"Good heavens!" she exclaimed. "What is the meaning of this? Is it possible that you take me, my lord, for one of those miserable creatures who force their way into houses to beg for alms? Take back your money. I am thankful to say I do not need it, for I belong to a beautiful lady who is very rich and gives me everything I want."
My brother was not clever enough to detect that the old woman had merely refused the 2 pieces of money he had offered her in order to get more, but he inquired if she could procure him the pleasure of seeing this lady.
"Willingly," she replied, "and she will be charmed to marry you and to make you the master of all her wealth. So pick up your money and follow me."
Delighted at the thought that he had found so easily both a fortune and a beautiful wife, my brother asked no more questions, but concealing his purse with the money the lady had given him in the folds of his dress, he set out joyfully with his guide. They walked for some distance till the old woman stopped at a large house where she knocked. The door was opened by a young Greek slave, and the old woman led my brother across a well-paved court into a well-furnished hall. Here she left him to inform her mistress of his presence, and as the day was hot he flung himself on a pile of cushions and took off his heavy turban. In a few minutes there entered a lady, and my brother perceived at the first glance that she was even more beautiful and more richly dressed than he had expected. He rose from his seat, but the lady signed to him to sit down again and placed herself beside him. After the usual compliments had passed between them, she said, "We are not comfortable here. Let us go into another room." And passing into a smaller chamber, apparently communicating with no other, she continued to talk to him for some time. Then, rising hastily, she left him, saying, "Stay where you are. I will come back in a moment." He waited as he was told, but instead of the lady there entered a huge black slave with a sword in his hand. Approaching my brother with an angry countenance, he exclaimed,
"What business have you here?"
His voice and manner were so terrific that Alnishar had not strength to reply, and allowed his gold to be taken from him, and even saber cuts to be inflicted on him without making any resistance. As soon as he was let go, he sank on the ground powerless to move, though he still had possession of his senses. Thinking he was dead, the black ordered the Greek slave to bring him some salt, and between them they rubbed it into his wounds, thus giving him acute agony, though he had the presence of mind to give no sign of life. They then left him, and their place was taken by the old woman, who dragged him to a trapdoor and threw him down into a vault filled with the bodies of murdered men. At first the violence of his fall caused him to lose consciousness, but luckily the salt, which had been rubbed into his wounds, had by its smarting preserved his life, and little by little he regained his strength. At the end of 2 days he lifted the trapdoor during the night and hid himself in the courtyard till daybreak, when he saw the old woman leave the house in search of more prey. Luckily she did not observe him, and when she was out of sight, he stole from this nest of assassins and took refuge in my house. I dressed his wounds and tended him carefully, and when a month had passed, he was as well as ever. His one thought was how to be revenged on that wicked old hag, and for this purpose he had a purse made large enough to contain 500 gold pieces, but filled it instead with bits of glass. This he tied round him with his sash, and, disguising himself as an old woman, he took a saber, which he hid under his dress. One morning, as he was hobbling through the streets, he met his old enemy, prowling to see if she could find anyone to decoy. He went up to her, and, imitating the voice of a woman, he said,
"Do you happen to have a pair of scales you could lend me? I have just come from Persia, and have brought with me 500 gold pieces, and I am anxious to see if they are the proper weight."
"Good woman," replied the old hag, "you could not have asked anyone better. My son is a money-changer, and if you will follow me he will weigh them for you himself. Only we must be quick, or he will have gone to his shop."
So saying, she led the way to the same house as before, and the door was opened by the same Greek slave. Again my brother was left in the hall, and the pretended son appeared under the form of the black slave.
"Miserable crone,"
he said to my brother,
"get up and come with me,"
and turned to lead the way to the place of murder. Al-Nashar rose too, and drawing the saber from under his dress, dealt the black such a blow on his neck that his head was severed from his body. My brother picked up the head with one hand, and seizing the body with the other, dragged it to the vault, when he threw it in and sent the head after it. The Greek slave, supposing that all had passed as usual, shortly arrived with a basin of salt, but when she beheld Al-Nashar with a saber in his hand, she let the basin fall and turned to fly. My brother, however, was too quick for her, and in another instant her head was rolling from her shoulders. The noise brought the old woman running to see what was the matter, and he seized her before she had time to escape.
"Wretch," he cried, "do you know me?"
"Who are you, my lord?"
she replied, trembling all over.
"I have never seen you before."
"I am he whose house you entered to offer your hypocritical prayers. Don't you remember me now?"
She flung herself on her knees to implore mercy, but he cut her in 4 pieces. There remained only the lady, who was quite ignorant of all that was taking place around her. He sought her through the house, and when at last he found her, she nearly fainted with terror at the sight of him. She begged hard for life, which he was generous enough to give her, but he bade her to tell him how she had got into partnership with the abominable creatures he had just put to death.
"I was once," replied she, "the wife of an honest merchant, and that old woman, whose wickedness I did not know, used occasionally to visit me. 'Madam,' she said to me one day, 'we have a grand wedding at our house today. If you would do us the honor to be present, I am sure you would enjoy yourself.' I allowed myself to be persuaded, put on my richest dress, and took a purse with 100 pieces of gold. Once inside the doors, I was kept by force by that dreadful black, and it is now 3 years that I have been here, to my great grief."
"That horrible black must have amassed great wealth," remarked my brother.
"Such wealth,"
returned she,
"that if you succeed in carrying it all away, it will make you rich forever. Come, and let us see how much there is."
She led Al-Nashar into a chamber filled with coffers packed with gold, which he gazed at with an admiration he was powerless to conceal.
Go, she said, and bring men to carry them away.
My brother did not wait to be told twice, and hurried out into the streets, where he soon collected 10 men. They all came back to the house, but what was his surprise to find the door open, and the room with the chests of gold quite empty. The lady had been cleverer than himself, and had made the best use of her time. However, he tried to console himself by removing all the beautiful furniture, which more than made up for the 500 gold pieces he had lost. Unluckily, on leaving the house, he forgot to lock the door, and the neighbors, finding the place empty, informed the police, who next morning arrested Alnishar as a thief. My brother tried to bribe them to let him off, but far from listening to him, they tied his hands and forced him to walk between them to the presence of the judge. When they had explained to the official the cause of complaint, he asked Alnishar where he had obtained all the furniture that he had taken to his house the day before.
Sir, replied Alnishar, I am ready to tell you the whole story, but give, I pray you, your word that I shall run no risk of punishment.
That I promise,
said the judge. So my brother began at the beginning and related all his adventures, and how he had avenged himself on those who had betrayed him. As to the furniture, he entreated the judge at least to allow him to keep part to make up for the 500 pieces of gold which had been stolen from him. The judge, however, would say nothing about this, and lost no time in sending men to fetch away all that Alnishar had taken from the house. When everything had been moved and placed under his roof, he ordered my brother to leave the town, and never more to enter it, on peril of his life, fearing that if he returned he might seek justice from the caliph. Alnishar obeyed, and was on his way to a neighboring city when he fell in with a band of robbers, who stripped him of his clothes and left him naked by the roadside. Hearing of his plight, I hurried after him to console him for his misfortunes and to dress him in my best robe. I then brought him back disguised, under cover of night, to my house, where I have since given him all the care I bestow on my other brothers.
The Story of the Barber's Sixth Brother.
There now remains for me to relate to you the story of my sixth brother, whose name was Schacabac. Like the rest of us, he inherited 100 silver drachmas from our father, which he thought was a large fortune, but through ill luck he soon lost it all and was driven to beg. As he had a smooth tongue and good manners, he really did very well in his new profession, and he devoted himself specially to making friends with the servants in big houses, so as to gain access to their masters. One day he was passing a splendid mansion, with a crowd of servants lounging in the courtyard. He thought that from the appearance of the house it might yield him a rich harvest, so he entered and inquired to whom it belonged.
"My good man, where do you come from?" replied the servant.
Can't you see for yourself that it can belong to nobody but a Barmecide?
For the Barmecides were famed for their liberality and generosity. My brother, hearing this, asked the porters, of whom there were several, if they would give him alms. They did not refuse, but told him politely to go in and speak to the master himself. My brother thanked them for their courtesy and entered the building, which was so large that it took him some time to reach the apartments of the Barmecide. At last, in a room richly decorated with paintings, he saw an old man with a long white beard sitting on a sofa, who received him with such kindness that my brother was emboldened to make his petition.
"My lord," he said, "you behold in me a poor man who only lives by the help of persons as rich and as generous as you."
Before he could proceed further, he was stopped by the astonishment shown by the Barmecide.
"Is it possible," he cried, "that while I am in Baghdad, a man like you should be starving? That is a state of things that must at once be put an end to. Never shall it be said that I have abandoned you, and I am sure that you, on your part, will never abandon me."
"My lord," answered my brother, I swear that I have not broken my fast this whole day.
What? You are dying of hunger? Exclaimed the Barmecide. Here, slave, bring water, that we may wash our hands before meat.
No slave appeared, but my brother remarked that the Barmecide did not fail to rub his hands, as if the water had been poured over them. Then he said to my brother,
Why don't you wash your hands, too?
And Shuckaback, supposing that it was a joke on the part of the Barmecide, though he could see none himself, drew near and imitated his motion. When the Barmecide had done rubbing his hands, he raised his voice and cried,
Set food before us at once! We are very hungry!
No food was brought, but the Barmecide pretended to help himself from a dish and carry a morsel to his mouth, saying as he did so,
Meat, my friend! Eat, I entreat! Help yourself as freely as if you were at home. For a starving man, you seem to have a very small appetite.
Excuse me, my lord, replied
Shuckaback, imitating his gestures as before.
I really am not losing time, and I do full justice to the repast.
How do you like this bread?
Asked the Barmecide.
I find it particularly good myself.
Oh, my lord,
answered my brother, who beheld neither meat nor bread,
never have I tasted anything so delicious.
Eat as much as you want, said the Barmecide. I bought the woman who makes it for 500 pieces of gold so that I might never be without it.
After ordering a variety of dishes, which never came, to be placed on the table, and discussing the merits of each one, the Barmecide declared that having dined so well, they would now proceed to take their wine. To this my brother at first objected, declaring that it was forbidden, but on the Barmecide insisting that it was out of the question that he should drink by himself, he consented to take a little. The Barmecide, however, pretended to fill their glasses so often that my brother feigned that the wine had gone into his head and struck the Barmecide such a blow on the head that he fell to the ground. Indeed, he raised his hand to strike him a second time when the Barmecide cried out that he was mad, upon which my brother controlled himself and apologized and protested that it was all the fault of the wine he had drunk. At this the Barmecide, instead of being angry, began to laugh, and embraced him heartily.
I have long been seeking,
he exclaimed,
a man of your description, and henceforth my house shall be yours. You have had the good grace to fall in with my humor, and to pretend to eat and to drink when nothing was there. Now you shall be rewarded by a really good supper.
Then he clapped his hands, and all the dishes were brought that they had tasted in imagination before and during the repast. Slaves sang and played on various instruments. All the while Shuckaback was treated by the Barmecide as a familiar friend, and dressed in a garment out of his own wardrobe. 20 years passed by, and my brother was still living with the Barmecide, looking after his house and managing his affairs. At the end of that time, his generous benefactor died without heirs, so all his possessions went to the prince. They even despoiled my brother of those that rightly belonged to him, and he, now as poor as he had ever been in his life, decided to cast in his lot with a caravan of pilgrims who were on their way to Mecca. Unluckily, the caravan was attacked and pillaged by the Bedouins, and the pilgrims were taken prisoners. My brother became the slave of a man who beat him daily, hoping to drive him to offer a ransom, although, as Shuckaback pointed out, it was quite useless trouble, as his relations were as poor as himself. At length the Bedouin grew tired of tormenting, and sent him on a camel to the top of a high barren mountain, where he left him to take his chance. A passing caravan on its way to Baghdad told me where he was to be found, and I hurried to his rescue and brought him in a deplorable condition back to the town. This,
continued the barber,
is the tale I related to the caliph, who, when I had finished, burst into fits of laughter.
Well, were you called the Silent?
Said he.
No name was ever better deserved. But for reasons of my own, which is not necessary to mention, I desire you to leave the town and never to come back.
I had, of course, no choice but to obey, and traveled about for several years, until I heard of the death of the Caliph, when I hastily returned to Baghdad, only to find that all my brothers were dead. It was at this time that I rendered to the young cripple the important service of which you have heard, and for which, as you know, he showed such profound ingratitude that he preferred rather to leave Baghdad than to run the risk of seeing me. I sought him long from place to place, but it was only today, when I expected at least, that I came across him, as much irritated with me as ever.
So saying, the tailor went on to relate the story of the lame man and the barber, which has already been told.
When the barber,
he continued,
had finished his tale, we came to the conclusion that the young man had been right, when he had accused him of being a great chatterbox. However, we wished to keep him with us and share our feast, and we remained at table till the hour of afternoon prayer. When the company broke up, I went back to work in my shop. It was during this interval that the little hunchback, half drunk already, presented himself before me, singing and playing on his drum. I took him home to amuse my wife, and she invited him to supper. While eating some fish, a bone got into his throat, and in spite of all we could do, he died shortly. It was all so sudden that we lost our heads, and in order to divert suspicion from ourselves, we carried the body to the house of a Jewish physician. He placed it in the chamber of the purveyor, and the purveyor propped it up in the street, where it was thought to have been killed by the merchant. This, sire, is the story which I was obliged to tell to satisfy your highness. It is now for you to say if we deserve mercy or punishment, life or death.
The Sultan of Kashgar listened with an air of pleasure, which filled the tailor and his friends with hope.
I must confess,
he exclaimed,
that I am much more interested in the stories of the barber and his brothers and of the lame man than in that of my own jester. But before I allow you all four to return to your own homes and have the corpse of the hunchback properly buried, I should like to see this barber who has earned your pardon. And as he is in this town, let an usher go with you at once in search of him.
The usher and the tailor soon returned, bringing with them an old man who must have been at least 90 years of age.
Oh, Silent One, said the Sultan, I am told that you know many strange stories. Will you tell some of them to me?
Never mind my stories for the present,
replied the barber.
But will your highness graciously be pleased to explain why this Jew, this Christian, and this Muslim, as well as this dead body, are all here?
What business is that of yours?
Asked the Sultan with a smile. But seeing that the barber had some reasons for his question, he commanded that the tale of the hunchback should be told him.
It is certainly most surprising,
cried he, when he had heard it all.
But I should like to examine the body.
He then knelt down and took the head on his knees, looking at it attentively. Suddenly he burst into such loud laughter that he fell right backwards, and when he had recovered himself enough to speak, he turned to the Sultan.
The man is no more dead than I am,
he said.
Watch me.
As he spoke, he drew a small case of medicines from his pocket and rubbed the neck of the hunchback with some ointment made of balsam. Next, he opened the dead man's mouth and, by the help of a pair of pincers, drew the bone from his throat. At this, the hunchback sneezed, stretched himself, and opened his eyes. The Sultan and all those who saw this operation did not know which to admire most, the constitution of the hunchback, who had apparently been dead for a whole night and most of one day, or the skill of the barber, whom everyone now began to look upon as a great man. His Highness desired that the history of the Hunchback should be written down and placed in the archives beside that of the Barber, so that they might be associated in people's minds to the end of time. And he did not stop there, for in order to wipe out the memory of what they had undergone, he commanded that the tailor, the doctor, the purveyor, and the merchant should each be clothed in his presence with a robe from his own wardrobe before they returned home. As for the barber, he bestowed on him a large pension and kept him near his own person. The Adventures of Prince Camaralzaman and the Princess Badoura. Some 20 days' sail from the coast of Persia lies the Isle of the Children of Khaledan. The island is divided into several provinces, in each of which are large, flourishing towns, and the whole forms an important kingdom. It was governed in former days by a king named Shahzaman, who, with good right, considered himself one of the most peaceful, prosperous, and fortunate monarchs on the earth. In fact, he had but one grievance, which was that none of his four wives had given him an heir. This distressed him so greatly that one day he confided his grief to the Grand Vizier, who, being a wise counselor, said,
"Such matters are indeed beyond human aid. Allah alone can grant your desire, and I should advise you, sire, to send large gifts to those holy men who spend their lives in prayer, and to beg for their intercessions. Who knows whether their petitions may not be answered?"
The king took his vizier's advice, and the result of so many prayers for an heir to the throne was that a son was born to him the following year. Shahzaman sent noble gifts as thank offerings to all the mosques and religious houses, and great rejoicings were celebrated in honor of the birth of the little prince, who was so beautiful that he was named Camaralzaman, or Moon of the Century. Prince Camaralzaman was brought up with extreme care by an excellent governor and all the cleverest teachers, and he did such credit to them that when he was grown up, a more charming and accomplished young man was not to be found. Whilst he was still a youth, the king, his father, who loved him dearly, had some thoughts of abdicating in his favor. As usual, he talked over his plans with his grand vizier, who, though he did not approve the idea, would not state all his objections.
"Sire," he replied, "the prince is still very young for the cares of state. Your majesty fears his growing idle and careless, and doubtless you are right. But how would it be if he were first to marry? This would attach him to his home, and your majesty might give him a share in your counsels, so that he might gradually learn how to wear a crown, which you can give up to him whenever you find him capable of wearing it."
The vizier's advice once more struck the king as being good, and he sent for his son, who lost no time in obeying the summons, and standing respectfully with downcast eyes before the king, asked for his commands.
"I have sent for you," said the king, "to say that I wish you to marry. What do you think about it?"
The prince was so much overcome by these words that he remained silent for some time. At length he said,
"Sire, I beg you to pardon me if I am unable to reply as you might wish. I certainly did not expect such a proposal, as I am still so young, and I confess that the idea of marrying is very distasteful to me. Possibly I may not always be in this mind, but I certainly feel that it will require some time to induce me to take the step which your majesty desires."
This answer greatly distressed the king, who was sincerely grieved by his objection to marriage. However, he would not have recourse to extreme measures, so he said,
"I do not wish to force you. I will give you time to reflect. But remember that such a step is necessary for a prince such as you, who will some day be called to rule over a great kingdom."
From this time, Prince Camaralzaman was admitted to the royal council, and the king showed him every mark of favor. At the end of a year, the king took his son aside and said,
"Well, my son, have you changed your mind on the subject of marriage, or do you still refuse to obey my wish?"
The prince was less surprised, but no less firm than on the former occasion, and begged his father not to press the subject, adding that it was quite useless to urge him any longer. The answer much distressed the king, who again confided his trouble to his vizier.
"I have followed your advice," he said, "but Kamaralzaman declines to marry, and is more obstinate than ever."
"Sire," replied the vizier, "much is gained by patience, and your majesty might regret any violence. Why not wait another year, and then inform the prince in the midst of the assembled council that the good of the state demands his marriage? He cannot possibly refuse again before so distinguished an assemblage, and in our immediate presence."
The sultan ardently desired to see his son married at once, but he yielded to the vizier's arguments and decided to wait. He then visited the prince's mother, and after telling her of his disappointment and of the further respite he had given his son, he added,
"I know that Kamaralzaman confides more in you than he does in me. Pray speak very seriously to him on this subject, and make him realize that he will most seriously displease me if he remains obstinate, and that he will certainly regret the measures I shall be obliged to take to enforce my will."
So the first time the Sultana Fatima saw her son, she told him she had heard of his refusal to marry, adding how distressed she felt that he should have vexed his father so much. She asked what reason he could have for his objections to obey.
"Madam," replied the prince, "I make no doubt that there are as many good, virtuous, sweet, and amiable women as there are others very much the reverse. Would that all were like you! But what revolts me is the idea of marrying a woman without knowing anything at all about her. My father will ask the hand of the daughter of some neighboring sovereign, who will give his consent to our union. Be she fair or frightful, clever or stupid, good or bad, I must marry her, and am left no choice in the matter. How am I to know that she will not be proud, passionate, contemptuous, and recklessly extravagant, or that her disposition will in any way suit mine?"
"But my son,"
urged Fatima,
"you surely do not wish to be the last of a race which has reigned so long and so gloriously over this kingdom?"
"Madam," said the prince, "I have no wish to survive the king, my father, but should I do so, I will try to reign in such a manner as may be considered worthy of my predecessors."
These and similar conversations proved to the sultan how useless it was to argue with his son, and the year elapsed without bringing any change in the prince's ideas. At length, a day came when the sultan summoned him before the council, and there informed him that not only his own wishes but the good of the empire demanded his marriage, and desired him to give his answer before the assembled ministers. At this, Kamaralzaman grew so angry and spoke with so much heat that the king, naturally irritated at being opposed by his son in full council, ordered the prince to be arrested and locked him in an old tower, where he had nothing but a very little furniture, a few books, and a single slave to wait on him. Kamaralzaman, pleased to be free to enjoy his books, showed himself very indifferent to his sentence. When night came, he washed himself, performed his devotions, and, having read some pages of the Quran, lay down on a couch without putting out the light near him, and was soon asleep. Now there was a deep well in the tower in which Prince Kamaralzaman was imprisoned, and this well was a favorite resort of the fairy Maimune, daughter of Damriat, chief of a legion of genii. Towards midnight, Maimune floated lightly up from the well, intending, according to her usual habit, to roam about the upper world as curiosity or accident might prompt. The light in the prince's room surprised her, and without disturbing the slave, who slept across the threshold, she entered the room, and approaching the bed was still more astonished to find it occupied. The prince lay with his face half hidden by the coverlet. Maimune lifted it a little, and beheld the most beautiful youth she had ever seen.
"What a marvel of beauty he must be when his eyes are open," she thought. "What can he have done to deserve to be treated like this?"
She could not weary gazing at Kamaralzaman, but at length, Having softly kissed his brow and each cheek, she replaced the coverlet and resumed her flight through the air. As she entered the middle region, she heard the sound of great wings coming towards her, and shortly met one of the race of bad genii. This genie, whose name was Dunhash, recognized Maimune with terror, for he knew the supremacy which her goodness gave her over him. He would gladly have avoided her altogether, but they were so near that he must either be prepared to fight or yield to her, so he at once addressed her in a conciliatory tone.
"Good Maimune, swear to me by Allah to do me no harm, and on my side I will promise not to injure you."
"Accursed genie," replied Maimune, "what harm can you do me? But I will grant your power and give the promise you ask. And now tell me what you have seen and done tonight."
"Fair lady," said Dunhash, "you meet me at the right moment to hear something really interesting. I must tell you that I come from the furthest end of China, which is one of the largest and most powerful kingdoms in the world. The present king has one only daughter, who is so perfectly lovely that neither you, nor I, nor any other creature could find adequate terms in which to describe her marvelous charms. You must therefore picture to yourself the most perfect features, joined to a brilliant and delicate complexion, and an enchanting expression, and even then, imagination will fall short of the reality. The king, her father, has carefully shielded this treasure from the vulgar gaze, and has taken every precaution to keep her from the sight of everyone except the happy mortal he may choose to be her husband. But in order to give her variety in her confinement, he has built her 7 palaces such as have never been seen before. The first palace is entirely composed of rock crystal, the second of bronze, the third of fine steel, the fourth of another and more precious species of bronze, the fifth of touchstone, the sixth of silver, and the seventh of solid gold. They are all most sumptuously furnished, whilst the gardens surrounding them are laid out with exquisite taste. In fact, neither trouble nor cost has been spared to make this retreat agreeable to the princess. The report of her wonderful beauty has spread far and wide, and many powerful kings have sent embassies to ask her hand in marriage. The king has always received these embassies graciously, but says that he will never oblige the princess to marry against her will, and as she regularly declines each fresh proposal, the envoys have had to leave as disappointed in the result of their missions as they were gratified by their magnificent receptions.
"Sire,"
said the princess to her father,
"you wish me to marry, and I know you desire to please me, for which I am very grateful. But indeed, I have no inclination to change my state, for where could I find so happy a life amidst so many beautiful and delightful surroundings? I feel that I could never be as happy with any husband as I am here, and I beg you not to press one on me."
At last an embassy came from a king so rich and powerful that the king of China felt constrained to urge this suit on his daughter. He told her how important such an alliance would be, and pressed her to consent. In fact, he pressed her so persistently that the princess at length lost her temper and quite forgot the respect due to her father.
"Sire,"
cried she angrily,
"do not speak further of this, or any other marriage, or I will plunge this dagger in my breast, and so escape from all these importunities."
The king of China was extremely indignant with his daughter, and replied,
"You have lost your senses, and you must be treated accordingly."
So he had her shut in one set of rooms in one of her palaces, and only allowed her 10 old women, of whom her nurse was the head, to wait on her and keep her company. He next sent letters to all the kings who had sued for the princess's hand, begging they would think of her no longer, as she was quite insane, and he desired his various envoys to make it known that anyone who could cure her should have her to wife.
"Fair Maimune,"
continued Dunhash,
"this is the present state of affairs. I never pass a day without going to gaze on this incomparable beauty. And I am sure that if you would only accompany me, you would think the sight well worth the trouble.
and own that you never saw such loveliness before."
The fairy only answered with a peal of laughter, and when at length she had control of her voice, she cried,
"Oh, come, you are making game of me. I thought you had something really interesting to tell me instead of raving about some unknown damsel. What would you say if you could see the prince I have just been looking at, and whose beauty is really transcendent? This is something worth talking about. You would certainly quite lose your head."
"Charming, my Monet," asked Dunhush. "May I inquire who and what is the prince of whom you speak?"
"No,"
replied Maimune,
"that he is in much the same case as your princess. The king, his father, wanted to force him to marry, and on the prince's refusal to obey, he has been imprisoned in an old tower where I have just seen him."
"I don't like to contradict a lady," said Dunhush, "but you must really permit me to doubt any mortal being as beautiful as my princess."
"Hold your tongue,"
cried Maimune.
"I repeat, that is possible."
"Well, I don't wish to seem obstinate," replied Dunhush. "The best plan to test the truth of what I say will be for you to let me take you to see the princess for yourself."
"There is no need for that," retorted Maimune. "We can satisfy ourselves in another way. Bring your princess here and lay her down beside my prince. We can then compare them at leisure and decide which is in the right."
Dunhush readily consented, and after having the tower where the prince was confined pointed out to him, and making a wager with Maimune as to the result of the comparison, he flew off to China to fetch the princess. In an incredibly short time, Dunhush returned, bearing the sleeping princess. Maimune led him to the prince's room, and the rival beauty was placed beside him. When the prince and princess lay thus side by side, an animated dispute as to their respective charms arose between the fairy and the genius. Dunhush began by saying,
"Now you see that my princess is more beautiful than your prince. Can you doubt any longer?"
"Doubt? Of course I do," exclaimed Maimune. "Why, you must be blind not to see how much my prince excels your princess. I do not deny that your princess is very handsome, but only look, and you must own that I am in the right."
"There is no need for me to look longer," said Dunhush. "My first impression will remain the same, but of course, charming, Maimune, I am ready to yield to you if you insist on it."
"By no means," replied Maimune. "I have no idea of being under any obligation to an accursed genius like you. I refer the matter to an umpire, and shall expect you to submit to his verdict."
Dunhush readily agreed, and on Maimune striking the floor with her foot, it opened, and a hideous, hump-backed, lame, squinting genius, with six horns on his head, hands like claws, emerged. As soon as he beheld Maimune, he threw himself at her feet and asked her commands.
"Rise, Kashkash," said she. "I summoned you to judge between me and Dunhush. Glance at that couch, and say without any partiality whether you think the youth or the maiden lying there the more beautiful."
Kashkash looked at the prince and princess with every token of surprise and admiration. At length, having gazed long without being able to come to a decision, he said,
"Madam, I must confess that I should deceive you were I to declare one to be handsomer than the other. There seems to me only one way in which to decide the matter, and that is to wake one after the other and judge which of them expresses the greater admiration for the other."
This advice pleased Maimune and Dunhush, and the fairy at once transformed herself into the shape of a gnat, and settling on Kamaralzaman's throat, stung him so sharply that he awoke. As he did so, his eyes fell on the Princess of China. Surprised at finding a lady so near him, he raised himself on one arm to look at her. The youth and beauty of the princess at once awoke a feeling to which his heart had as yet been a stranger, and he could not restrain his delight.
"What loveliness! What charms! Oh, my heart! My soul!"
he exclaimed as he kissed her forehead, her eyes, and mouth, in a way which would certainly have roused her had not the genie's enchantments kept her asleep.
"How, fair lady," he cried, "you do not wake at the signs of Kamar al-Zaman's love? Be you who you may, he is not unworthy of you."
It then suddenly occurred to him that perhaps this was the bride his father had destined for him, and that the king had probably had her placed in this room in order to see how far Kamar al-Zaman's aversion to marriage would withstand her charms.
"At all events," he thought, "I will take this ring as a remembrance of her."
So saying, he drew off a fine ring which the princess wore on her finger, and replaced it by one of his own, after which he lay down again, and was soon fast asleep. Then Danhasch, in his turn, took the form of a gnat, and bit the princess on her lip. She started up, and was not a little amazed at seeing a young man beside her. From surprise she soon passed to admiration, and then to delight on perceiving how handsome and fascinating he was.
"Why,"
cried she,
"was it you my father wished me to marry? How unlucky that I did not know sooner! I should not have made him so angry, but wake up, wake up! For I know I shall love you with all my heart."
So saying, she shook Kamar al-Zaman so violently that nothing but the spells of Maimune could have prevented his waking.
"Oh,"
cried the princess,
"why are you so drowsy?"
So saying, she took his hand and noticed her own ring on his finger, which made her wonder still more. But as he still remained in a profound slumber, she pressed a kiss on his cheek, and soon fell fast asleep too. Then Maimune, turning to the genie, said,
"Well, are you satisfied that my prince surpasses your princess? Another time, pray believe me when I assert anything."
Then turning to Kashkash,
"Many thanks to you, and now do you and Danhasch bear the princess back to her own home."
The two genii hastened to obey, and Maimune returned to her well. On waking next morning, the first thing Prince Kamar al-Zaman did was to look round for the lovely lady he had seen at night, and the next to question the slave who waited on him about her. But the slave persisted so strongly that he knew nothing of any lady, and still less of how she got into the tower, that the prince lost all patience, and after giving him a good beating, tied a rope round him, and ducked him in the well till the unfortunate man cried out that he would tell everything. Then the prince drew him up all dripping wet, but the slave begged leave to change his clothes first, and as soon as the prince consented, hurried off just as he was to the palace. Here he found the king talking to the grand vizier of all the anxiety his son had caused him. The slave was admitted at once and cried,
"Alas, sire, I bring sad news to your majesty. There can be no doubt that the prince has completely lost his senses. He declares that he saw a lady sleeping on his couch last night, and the state you see me in proves how violent contradiction makes him."
He then gave a minute account of all the prince had said and done. The king, much moved, begged the vizier to examine into this new misfortune, and the latter at once went to the tower, where he found the prince quietly reading a book. After the first exchange of greetings, the vizier said,
"I feel really very angry with your slave for alarming his majesty by the news he brought him."
"What news?" asked the prince.
"Ah," replied the vizier, "something absurd, I feel sure, seeing how I find you."
"Most likely," said the prince, "but now that you are here, I am glad of the opportunity to ask you where is the lady who slept in this room last night."
The grand vizier felt beside himself at this question.
"Prince," he exclaimed, "how would it be possible for any man, much less a woman, to enter this room at night without walking over the slave on the threshold? Pray consider the matter, and you will realize that you have been deeply impressed by some dream."
But the prince angrily insisted on knowing who and where the lady was, and was not to be persuaded by all the vizier's protestations to the contrary that the plot had not been one of his making. At last, losing patience, he seized the vizier by the beard and loaded him with blows.
"Stop, prince," cried the unhappy vizier. "Stay and hear what I have to say."
The prince, whose arm was getting tired, paused.
"I confess, prince," said the vizier, "that there is some foundation for what you say,
but you know well that a minister has to carry out his master's orders. Allow me to go, and to take to the king any message you may choose to send."
"Very well," said the prince. "Then go and tell him that I consent to marry the lady whom he sent or brought here last night. Be quick and bring me back his answer."
The vizier bowed to the ground and hastened to leave the room and tower.
"Well," asked the king as soon as he appeared, "and how did you find my son?"
"Alas, sire," was the reply, "the slave's report is only too true."
He then gave an exact account of his interview with Kamar al-Zaman, and of the prince's fury when told that it was not possible for any lady to have entered his room, and of the treatment he himself had received. The king, much distressed, determined to clear up the matter himself, and, ordering the vizier to follow him, set out to visit his son. The prince received his father with profound respect, and the king, making him sit beside him, asked him several questions, to which Kamar al-Zaman replied with much good sense. At last the king said,
"My son, pray tell me about the lady who, it is said, was in your room last night."
"Sire," replied the prince, "pray do not increase my distress in this matter, but rather make me happy by giving her to me in marriage. However much I may have objected to matrimony formerly, the sight of this lovely girl has overcome all my prejudices, and I will gratefully receive her from your hands."
The king was almost speechless on hearing his son, but after a time assured him most solemnly that he knew nothing whatever about the lady in question, and had not connived at her appearance. He then desired the prince to relate the whole story to him. Kamar al-Zaman did so at great length, showed the ring, and implored his father to help to find the bride he so ardently desired.
"After all you tell me," remarked the king, "I can no longer doubt your word. But how and whence the lady came, or why she should have stayed so short a time, I cannot imagine. The whole affair is indeed mysterious. Come, my dear son, let us wait together for happier days."
So saying, the king took Kamar al-Zaman by the hand and led him back to the palace, where the prince took to his bed and gave himself up to despair. And the king, shutting himself up with his son, entirely neglected the affairs of state. The prime minister, who was the only person admitted, felt it his duty at last to tell the king how much the court and all the people complained of his seclusion, and how bad it was for the nation. He urged the sultan to remove with the prince to a lovely little island close by, whence he could easily attend public audiences, and where the charming scenery and fine air would do the invalid so much good as to enable him to bear his father's occasional absence. The king approved the plan, and as soon as the castle on the island could be prepared for their reception, he and the prince arrived there, Shahzaman never leaving his son except for the prescribed public audiences twice a week. Whilst this was happening in the capital of Shahzaman, the two genii had carefully borne the Princess of China back to her own palace and replaced her in bed. On waking next morning, she first turned from one side to another, and then, finding herself alone, called loudly for her women.
"Tell me," she cried, "where is the young man I love so dearly, and who slept near me last night?"
"Princess," exclaimed the nurse, "we cannot tell what you allude to without more explanation."
"Why," continued the princess, "the most charming and beautiful young man lay sleeping beside me last night. I did my utmost to wake him, but in vain."
"Your Royal Highness wishes to make game of us," said the nurse.
"Is it your pleasure to rise?" "I am quite in earnest," persisted the princess, "and I want to know where he is."
"But, princess," expostulated the nurse, "we left you quite alone last night, and we have seen no one enter your room since then."
At this the princess lost all patience, and taking the nurse by her hair, she boxed her ears soundly, crying out,
"You shall tell me, you old witch, or I'll kill you!"
The nurse had no little trouble in escaping, and hurried off to the queen, to whom she related the whole story with tears in her eyes.
"You see, madam," she concluded, "that the princess must be out of her mind. If only you will come and see her, you will be able to judge for yourself."
The queen hurried to her daughter's apartments, and after tenderly embracing her, asked her why she had treated her nurse so badly.
Madam, said the princess, I perceive that your majesty wishes to make game of me, but I can assure you that I will never marry anyone except the charming young man whom I saw last night. You must know where he is, so pray send for him.
The queen was much surprised at these words, but when she declared that she knew nothing whatever of the matter, the princess lost all respect, and answered that if she were not allowed to marry as she wished, she should kill herself, and it was in vain that the queen tried to pacify her and bring her to reason. The king himself came to hear the rights of the matter, but the princess only persisted in her story, and as a proof showed the ring on her finger. The king hardly knew what to make of it all, but ended by thinking that his daughter was more crazy than ever, and without further argument, he had her placed in still closer confinement, with only her nurse to wait on her and a powerful guard to keep the door. Then he assembled his council, and having told them the sad state of things, added,
If any of you can succeed in curing the princess, I will give her to him in marriage, and he shall be my heir.
An elderly emir present, fired with the desire to possess a young and lovely wife and to rule over a great kingdom, offered to try the magic arts with which he was acquainted.
You are welcome to try, said the king, but I make one condition, which is that should you fail, you will lose your life.
The emir accepted the condition, and the king led him to the princess, who, veiling her face, remarked,
I am surprised, sire, that you should bring an unknown man into my presence.
You need not be shocked, said the king. This is one of my emirs who asks your hand in marriage.
Sire, replied the princess, this is not the one you gave me before and whose ring I wear. Permit me to say that I can accept no other.
The emir, who had expected to hear the princess talk nonsense, finding how calm and reasonable she was, assured the king that he could not venture to undertake a cure, but placed his head at his majesty's disposal, on which the justly irritated monarch promptly had it cut off. This was the first